Ed Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. To begin today's broadcast, host Craig Lubo talks with Richard Mabian, president of the Kansas City, Kansas chapter of the NAACP, about their efforts to break the school-to-prison pipeline with job training programs and more. Then, in the second half, host Margot Patterson talks with Nassim Katha of the Alliance for Global Justice about how the USA is exporting our incarceration policies and prison industrial complex across the globe. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast.
Right. Good morning, and thank you for joining us here on Jaws of Justice. This is Craig Lubo, and my guest today is Richard Mabian.
Good morning.
And many of you probably know him from Eco Radio, one of my co-hosts.
Yes.
Besides being in environmental justice and community activist, he's also community activist in other issues, too. And he is the president of the Kansas City, Kansas NAACP
branch.
And then, do you have a position? One time, I think you said on the state chapter too for the NAACP.
Well, I'm the environmental czar for the state chapter. They probably wouldn't call me the czar, but I just threw that in there for the radio. So I'm the environmental chairperson too.
All right. So today, though, we're going to talk about the NAACP issues, although they deal with environment, too, but we'll save that for another day.
Right.
And what I want to get into, some people call it the prison, schools to prison pipeline, and you were on, we don't want to say the name of the other station, but you were on another station where they were talking to you after a couple of the murders that occurred in Kansas City, Kansas, in the downtown area. And what some of the problems were in the youth justice issues.
Right.
So let me have you just get into some of your ideas on that, and then I'll ask you some specific questions.
Okay. First of all, I'm really honored to be here. I know when this program started, Jaws of Justice, Jeff Humphield's a very close friend of mine, and so having the chance to actually be here to speak is okay. I'm a little nervous being here with Craig because he's one of those kind of persons that can ask you a question you wasn't expecting. So don't get upset if you hear me go, I'm not answering it. But I was really glad when he called me. Let's start with the fact that the prisoner population in and out has not been a portion of the population that I've worked with. You know, you can't do it all. You call me an activist. I like to consider myself a community organizer. And because activists can live next door to each other and not even speak, not even realize that they have various issues that they're working on, where a community organizer has his mind and his intention involved with the total community.
I think President Obama had always called himself a community organizer.
But I go back even further than him because President Obama became a community organizer when it was a position. And I became a community organizer when it was a mission. No one was hired as a community organizer. You went out and organized the community. That's just the difference. And that's where I am now. I'm more concerned about creating a sustainable Earth community. And in order to do that, you have to bring in all segments of society to participate in that effort. And the one area that I've been weak on is two areas. Actually, the spiritual one, even though I'm very spiritual, that's not my cup of tea as far as being able to provide the leadership that would be needed in that community, but at least I do understand it. And this prison one, what is it? What do they call it when you come back home? oh wow, I lost the word. But anyhow, that's it. Not because I'm not aware of it. I'm aware of it because this is within my confines. This is within my area. Your reentry. Right. But as far as having the intricate details and the philosophical points of views and stuff, I haven't been there. Like I said, you can't do it all. So the reason, that's why it's so, it was really ironic, and I know you didn't say the name of the other station that did the interview with me, but I will tell them it was on TV, so they had my pretty face on there, something that you all can't see. But still, they asked me these questions, and it was at a time when I was, while I'm right now going through a process of using, of looking at the community from the perspective of what's missing. And a lot of the circumstances that's going on in our community has to do with the lack of opportunity. And like I was explaining to them, even though, you know, I'm one of those persons that talk long and then they make sound bites out of what you said. And one of the things that they missed was me saying, here we got a group of people out here, a portion of the population that just fluffed off during the time when they should have been learning. And some of them even quit school by 16, just dropped out. Now they've gotten to be in their 20s and headed toward 30s. And like people, they have picked up responsibilities. They got kids. They got need to pay rent, to buy food. And they have no marketable skills. Past getting a job at McDonald's, you know, UPS, if possible, and that's too hard work. They really don't want to work there. They're limited in where they can make an income, and that has made the streets look attractive because they see these people out there in the streets with whining and dining and looking like they just making all the money in the world with the fancy cars and the programs on TV and the themes of your rap music and all the kind of things that's manipulating these individuals and thinking, this is the way for me to be able to do what I need to do as a man. Wrong. And we all know that's a false illusion. So I'm saying, as a community, we need to be able to come together and try to figure out how we can get these people retrained with some type of marketable skill to be able to put them in a position to make an income, because that's what the bottom line is. Everybody out there is not a criminal. Some folks out there, because they got responsibilities. We need to figure out how we can separate those people that or have the responsibilities from the mainline folks out there so that we can then concentrate on two separate groups, okay? Am I making sense what I'm saying?
I'm not real clear.
Okay, good. This is where your questions come. Let's go. I'm ready.
Okay. So, well, in terms of opportunity in the schools.
Okay.
Is the problem with the schools, or is the problem with the broader community? Why are kids dropping out at the rate they do in Kansas City, Kansas?
Well, my attitude about schools, and you know, I'm very much involved with doing science. We got programs where we're teaching kids about scientifically testing water, going in with the river keepers here in Kansas, river keepers, and now I'm working with them on the MOU. So we're in the school teaching kids how to be able to do that. So I'm not going to tell you that there aren't things going on, but the school system itself is hamstrung with this No Child Left Behind. I'm in the schools from time to time, and I get a chance to see what's going on. We got some great teachers. We got some mediocre teachers. We got some bad teachers. We got some great students. We got some mediocre students. We got some bad students, like anything should be. But the problem is No Child Left Behind does not allow teachers, even the good teachers, to teach. So if there's something that they need to be able to focus in on and do what they need to do to make sure that these students have that going on or they understand it, just like you said you didn't understand what I was saying, we can expand into it and talk about it. They really don't have the time to do it because they have requirements, you know, almost like daily requirements of what needs to be done as far as the schedule is concerned. So because of that, the kids are being left behind. I mean, they're there, but they're not. They're left behind. So it gets to the point that the school is not attractive to them. I mean, you know, and when they get, I've went to one school, and the kids were so bad. They were such bad actors. I mean, not all of them, but like one or two of them, that they had to have like one of the security people go from class to class with them. They're too young to kick out. I mean, they let them leave at 16. So to keep them in some kind of order, they had this guy walking around with them, you know? And that's a horrible situation to put our students in and put our teachers in. But that's what's going on. And I'm not sin everywhere, so please, people, don't throw bricks at me when you see me. But that is going on out there in those in some of our school situations.
Is part of the problem that we don't expect enough of the kids? And what I'm thinking of, I used to have a friend who was a teacher at the alternative school in Kansas City, Kansas. Mm. So, of course, they're dealing with the hard to deal with students, but this was true even in some of the regular schools, and they typically don't assign homework. Oh. They do all the work in class. There's almost no homework assigned, and he told me the reason they do that is they're afraid the kids will drop out of school if they have to do homework.
Right.
So doesn't that become kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that the kids are going to slack off? You know, be slack offs and not do anything that they're supposed to do because they're not expected to?
Right, and you understand that was one of those situations where a teacher's not able to teach because of the system that they're working under. He didn't get that on his own. He got that in his orientation when he's going in to work at the schools. No sense of you doing it because they won't do it. They'll drop out. That is what we're up against.
And I remember contrasting that when I was in school in Shawnee Mission School District, and we had about 2 hours of homework every night.
I cannot even remember what you were teaching. I can't remember what it was when I was in school. But yes, we had homework. We had things we had to do. But now to go to the next other side of it, when those students drop out and after they didn't got themselves in a series of troubles or whatever else, one of the programs out there that's being used to touch these young people is Youth Build. Youth Bill, they're dealing with students from 16 to 24. And what they do is take them in and they're teaching them the construction industry, the construction trade. And it's male and female. Now, I'm not going to say it's the perfect thing, but it is the kids, the youngsters that are in there, they get a stipend while they're there, and they are graduating from the program. I mean, you know, they receive certificates, they receive their GEDs, and they're getting skills that are marketable. Problem being, no one hires them. So here I got kids running around that got the skills, and you know, and you talk Youth Bill, you talking 20 kids in a year, and you know, and I got 5,000 kids running around with nothing to do. But it is a program that's worked and a program that made me understand the value of skills and the need for a job. Because those kids, when they're in there getting those skills and they're getting their little stipend, they're not out there ripping and running the streets, even though some will. But as a generally, they really become addicted to that program. And so that's another one that I would keep my eye on to see, okay, here's a kind of a model of something that can be used. It needs more. It needs more. In other words, there needs to be programs associated with it that would be the next stepping stone that the kids that's involved in a program can actually see. If I'm in Youth Bill and I see somebody who looks like me at the next level that's getting some skill training and something, then that kind of motivates me to continue doing what I'm doing because there's a possibility of an opportunity. That's the opportunity that I'm talking about needs to exist.
But so you're talking about a program that's focused on manual labor.
Well,
what programs do we have that focus on kids who are struggling and maybe they've dropped out? But they want to get back in. They want an education. They don't know where to go, and there's not much available for, you know, professional type jobs. Maybe they decide they want to be a doctor, and they've already messed up their education. What do they do to get into an opportunity.
Well, we'll take that one in a lifetime possibility and say that there will probably be a way we can figure out to find this one person that can talk to that one individual and guide them and lead them in the direction they're trying to go. My thing for what I'm looking at right now is these people have limited their possibilities in life already. So for us as a community to be of value to that group, we have to realistically look at what it is they're going to be able to do. Now, I'm going to tell you something. This infrastructure redoing in America is probably the last time this group of people we're talking about have a chance to be led into an occupation that would be a decent paying job. That infrastructure, refacing the roads and the bridges and all the stuff we got to do. And this is probably the last one. I know here in Kansas City, we got the storm drain issue, replacing the storm drain. It's a 25-year program. So if you give me a 16-year-old and we can get them trained by the time they're 18, then I got a kid at 18-year-old that has the skill and the possibility to have a job out here that's going to last for 25 years. That's not bad. That's motivational. I mean, that's the opportunity that I'm talking about. But if you don't have the skills, I'm not expecting Burns and McDonald's, who is the caretaker of our storm drain replacement program, to feel that they need to hire this person. No, that's not it. But I'm saying we need to be able to, for those who are capable of taking that step, have a way of getting that person to that point. Yes, that's manual labor, some of it. They got other things. They got the computer stuff. They're using cameras that are going down in the ground now and all that kind of stuff. But it is one of the few jobs that's left. That's the only group that I'm really concentrating on for that possibility. Backing up to K through 12, we have to change the way these kids are received being taught in school. That's a totally different story. We can't allow them to wait until they get to be 15 or 16 years old to start talking about what am I going to be doing. We got to start with them much earlier than that. So then your doctor person, we will have caught maybe when he was in the fourth grade.
Okay. Now, one of the things that we want to talk about is the Kansas City, Missouri set a new record for, murders. I think it was a record for murders.
Yes.
I don't know if Kansas City, Kansas set a record or not.
They have a bunch.
And we know that some types of crime is partially due to the lack of opportunity, lack of education, and they're out on the streets with nothing to do. But that doesn't typically cause somebody to become violent and murder people. I mean, 99% of the people who live in Kansas City, Kansas are not out there murdering people, even though they might be high school dropouts and don't have the opportunities.
Right.
So what are some of the things that you think are contributing to why does that small group of people become killers?
All right. Human behavior is my background. That is what I ended up being selected for when I came through the ranks in life. My color and my trade, because it's just like right now we're talking about a portion of the population that I serve. That's a tough question. I am baffled at the seriousness that we should have for the murder and mayhem that's going on in our communities. And I feel that, again, this is a societal problem. I'm not saying society causes it as much as society is covering it up. They don't want people to be that article, that news report that was being done on me was because they wanted to hear me talk about how because these two people had been shot in downtown Kansas City, Kansas, how that's negative for the businesses because people don't want to come in to Kansas City, Kansas. And that's basically what that was about. And that's kind of the theme that people use in those kind of cases. But we're dealing, I know you're not going to like to hear this because of your affiliations, but I think it's due to a demonic spirit, okay? And and I'm being very honest about you, and I think society needs to be coming together and stop the silo. I've talked about silos. We have entirely too many individual silos in the inner city that are working to save people that are not working in concert with each other. They're working independent of one another. So consequently, you shouldn't. I mean, I cannot believe that on Christmas, a person can get in his car and drive around this city and stop at different centers and get the same handout of food that everybody else is getting, throw it in the car, drive to the next one, get the handout, throw it in the car. We are enabling people in such a way that these programs, for their need to get those funds to say, look at what I've done, are actually putting the people in the community in a situation where it's convenient to just go out and use stuff like that. Well, the murder thing is the same way. I'm going to be honest with you. I can sit here and talk to you about the employment stuff. I can talk to you. I remember I told you, boy, when it came to the prison thing, I wasn't really on top of it, but I know and can see how it fits into this now, and there needs to be a separate entity that's dealing with that. That murder thing, we need to come together on that. I'm being honest with you, because it is. I'm not going to say it's out of proportion, but it's ridiculous. I mean, when you're driving down the road, I leave here at night when I leave the Eco Radio Show, and I worry about driving from here home in the dark because of some nut bucket standing out there on the street shooting the daggum gun. Now, that's what happened over here on the highway the other night. The man's going home with his son, the two idiots running down the highway shooting at each other. Okay? Mm-hmm. The problem is that the punishment for that should be severe. But they'll go over there and get 3-4 years. They'll be back on the streets. That's crazy. So I'm saying it's an issue that we need to come together as people and carry on, have this dialogue. But the problem is we in this part, well, everywhere really, but really here, I'm only speaking about where I am. I'm not going to talk about other places. Have this top-down decision-making stuff going on. So by the time decisions get down to the bottom, just like the guy in the class in the alternative school, they've been told what they're supposed to do. By the time the decisions get down to where it really matters, people don't have any input. They told what they're supposed to do. So consequently, the people making decisions are deciding this is the reason that Johnny's doing it. Ain't no fathers in the home. That's why the kids are bad. That is not an excuse for a kid to be bad because he ain't got a daddy in the home. But we use that psychologically and give them what I consider to be an edge for you being a nut bucket, y'all, for those, since I can't cuss on the air. And that's crazy. So when you talk about the shooting, I don't understand. I'll be honest with you. But it's like in the families where these little people come from, they don't criticize that. It's okay. He's sitting at home. He's sitting at home on the couch. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just got through killing somebody and looking crazy. And he's sitting on the couch. He's engaged in conversation with folks in the house with people getting killed, and they go on with their life like it don't matter. Hey, that's a problem, and that's not ethnic. No, that's social economics. That's a different situation.
So we just have about 1 minute left. So tell me, are there programs out there to work with these kids to address those issues?
Well, I'll put it like this. We got a chance in Kansas City right now, and I'm hoping that we'll pull it off, and I'm going to take ownership for it, of trying to use one of EPA's programs, the Brownfield, the Health Field program, mm-hmm. and use that as this job training possibility. We've gone together with El Centro, which is the leading Latino organization in the Kansas City metropolitan area in Kansas City, Kansas, EOF, which is Economic Opportunity Foundation, Donnelly College, and I'm there as president of the NAACP, but I'm not really active. I'm all doing is being a conduit for bringing them together, and they just applied for a job training grant so that they can take control of actually training their clients, not have some outside organization come walking in here with a whole bunch of white folks to train their clients, but where they can actually train people on their job the people that they work with every day, that the people who listen to them and they have they can reach, and now start working with them of getting these skills we're talking about and then moving them into a job. We got two or three places in town that have agreed to be their job. So, yes, that's in what we're trying to work here in Kansas City.
All right. So, I want to thank you for being here. For those who just joined us, you were listening to Richard Mabian from NAACP, and we'll have you back sometime.
Please do. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Now, the calendar for January 22nd. Corey's Network and the Chuck E. Cheese at 18701 East 39th Street at the Independence Mall, Independence, Missouri, are teaming up again to raise funds to help pay funeral costs for a murdered child. Chuck E. Cheese will donate 15% of all proceeds purchased at the register Friday, January 26th, 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. Let them know by saying, "I'm here with Corey." Ever wonder if it really is in the water? There have been reports of contamination from numerous sources in the news. Homeowners can find out what is in their water by taking a two-hour water science class, getting 8 comprehensive scientific tests to teach about the many hidden toxins in their water and what they can do about it. For more information, contact Aaron Burroughs of God's Will in Action at 660-202-0090. American Public Square and the Truman Library Institute present Ensuring a Future, the ACA and American Healthcare Reform, Thursday, February 1st at Pearson Auditorium in the Atterbury Student Success Center, 5000 Holmes Street, KCMO. There will be a reception at 5:30 p.m. and the program will start at 6:30 p.m. The panel will include Joseph Antos of the American Enterprise Institute, Rachel Newsom of the Commonwealth Fund, Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News, and David Slusky, Assistant Economics Professor at Kansas University. To register to attend this event, go to AmericanPublicSquare.org/ACA. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Now to Margot and her guest.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. From Afghanistan to Brazil, from Mexico to Morocco, from Senegal to Serbia, the U.S. government provides foreign countries assistance in building and managing their prisons. My guest today is Nassim Chatta, who works for the Alliance for Global Justice, a nonprofit that promotes grassroots movements for ecological and economic justice. Ms. Chacha coordinates the organization's PRISM Imperialism Project, and she is here to talk to us about how and why the United States is exporting, often secretly, its system of prisons and prison management to different countries, particularly those in Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East. Nassim, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Let's begin by talking about the extent of U.S. involvement in other countries' prisons. If you would, tell us how many countries in the world have U.S. prison programs operating in them. And then, secondly, if you could, say what are these programs and what do they involve?
Sure. So the U.S. is involved in the prisons of 38 different countries around the world, mostly in Latin America, Africa, and some in Asia as well. So that's actually about 20% of all the countries worldwide. So it's a pretty huge number. So what these programs entail is basically that tens of thousands of foreign correctional officers around the world have been taught U.S. incarceration techniques. So that's one aspect. And the U.S. also has over 100 prison advisors in different countries around the world. Finally, the U.S. also builds prisons. So there's 6 new prisons, for example, built in Colombia based on U.S. prison designs, and the U.S. has also been has built prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan, and there's also prisons being scheduled for completion in Africa as well, in Niger. So this, yeah, so this whole thing has been going on since the U.S. and Colombia signed the Program for the Improvement of Colombian Prisons in 2000, and it subsequently spread from there all around the world. The things that the U.S. is teaching can be characterized by a shift overall towards a culture of militarized containment and retribution rather than rehabilitation. And the funding goes through the, and these programs are run through the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, which is a program of the State Department. And these this prison programs are usually an accompaniment to broader programs of justice sector restructuring. So that would involve the police and the courts, which are also things that the U.S. would be involved in influencing in these same countries where we're involved in the prison system.
Well, I'm curious how these programs get started in different countries. Who usually approaches who? Is it the United States that first offers its assistance, or is this something that many countries genuinely want and need and approach the United States about?
Well, one of the interesting things about it is that it's actually pretty clandestine. The State Department is kind of a black box, so we don't really know all that much about these programs. And in fact, I don't think we would know anything at all had we not kind of tried to figure these things out from outside of the U.S. So I'm not sure who initially approaches who. One of the interesting things about Plan Colombia, which is that very first U.S. international U.S. prison program that I mentioned that got started in 2000 and was the very first one. Plan Colombia is said to have originally been drafted in English, but it's supposed to be kind of by and for the Colombian people. So the fact that it was originally drafted in English sort of speaks to the fact that it's a U.S.-led and really U.S.-controlled initiative. So to answer the other part of your question, why do countries seem to want this and seem to agree to have the U.S. come in and restructure their prison systems? It is actually something that countries can use to sort of project a military strength and to perhaps exert intimidation on their own populations. So it projects strength for them to have these prison systems. I think we've seen this a lot in the U.S., like a conservative government can retain a lot of power by creating fear around crime or sort of emphasizing that they're going to be the ones to be really tough on crime. So, and it's usually sort of conservative governments that choose to ally with the U.S. in this way or sort of right-wing, perhaps neoliberal regimes that really want to sell themselves as law and order and turn prisons into this intimidating kind of theater of war that they can use to minimize dissent in their own countries.
Well, I want to get back to that, but first I have a question about how the Alliance for Global Justice and yourself ever learned about these programs. And if they are secret, why?
Yeah, sure. So ASGJ started to learn about these programs in about 2009. So they had already been going on for about 8 years, but nobody in the U.S. at least really knew that the U.S. was involved in the prison systems of other countries, and there really hadn't been writing about it. So I still hadn't started working for AFGJ at the time, but my coworker
That's the Alliance for Global Justice. Let me just jump in. That's what you're referring to, correct?
Oh, sure. Yeah, AFGJ, Alliance for Global Justice. But my coworker James was working with groups in Colombia that were supporting political prisoners. And Colombia was in a very complex, long-lasting social and armed conflict until 2015. So activists of different stripes were jailed by the government, and that could include union activists, left-wing guerrilla, communist guerrillas, different types of people. And so many people here and in Colombia started seeing that a lot of these new political prisoners were being sent to this one particular prison, La Tramacua, which was off in this part of Colombia that's very hot and very and it was very far away from major cities. And it was an exceptionally bad prison, even by Colombia standards. So it was poorly designed. It got about 10 minutes of water a day to prisoners. So they had to create this elaborate system for how they were going to allocate it amongst themselves, the incarcerated people. There was fecal contamination. A majority of the population inside was reporting that they were sick. There were repeated instances of torture. So bad place. And then our allies in Colombia were telling us that this was a U.S. prison that the people were being locked up in. So my coworker, James, thought to himself, that's a first. Like, we know that the U.S. was deeply involved in the military and the police, and even the justice sector, but the prison thing seemed new. So he started reading State Department documents, and sort of deep in there, he found out that there was something called the Program for the Improvement of Colombian Prisons signed by both countries. And at the time, there actually was a little bit more out there about this stuff, and then increasingly they sort of stopped talking about it once the State Department figured out that people were being critical of these programs, they sort of stopped publicizing it. But initially, it was sort of supposed to be, it was publicized as this almost progressive thing. And from there, we learned that there was a plan for over a dozen new prisons. As it turns out, six were actually built in Colombia by the current day. So we kept on poking around in these State Department documents. Elsewhere, he found out that the U.S. was involved in the prison systems of over 20 different countries, but just nothing about how or why. So now we know that the total is more like 38 countries that the U.S. is involved in.
And from what I understand, the U.S. involvement in other countries' prisons began, in, as you mentioned, Colombia, with the drug war, but then spread to other countries as part of the war on terror. Can you talk a little bit about the terrorism-related aspect to this?
Sure. So, yeah, indeed, as you said, the prisons were started in Colombia, which the whole logic of that was the international war on drugs, and that if the stated logic was if we're going to be getting these narco traffickers, there has to be a way to keep them securely locked up. So, and that's why the U.S. said that they were getting involved in the Colombian prisons. In reality, of course, there were plenty of just regular poor people locked up, but also activists, union members, things like that. But so right away, So the Colombia prison was conceived of in about 2000, just around there. It got built, it opened up in 2001. And then Guantanamo, the prison at Guantanamo was established in 2002. So they're different in an important way, which is that the Colombian prisons were nominally not U.S. run. And the Guantanamo and the other CIA black sites are U.S. run. But in actuality, the difference is often very blurry. Like in Colombia, the U.S. Bureau of Prisons had an office in there when it first went up in this prison, La Tramacua. And then in countries like Iran, Iraq and Afghanistan, we actually built up their prison systems in a very similar way to what we did in Colombia. So the war on drugs and the war on terror are pretty much part of the same engine, like part of the same programs in the U.S. State Department. They get dealt with this kind of the same way. And then William Brownfield, who was ambassador to Colombia, but then became in charge of these prison programs in the State Department, he actually said that we get a C plus to a B minus at best on getting Afghanistan, Colombia, and Iraq to use their prison systems in a way that meets their objective. So he's kind of like, we didn't really succeed in any of these countries. But the other thing I think is important to mention about the war on drugs and the war on terror is that both of them, narco-trafficking exists and global terrorism definitely exists, but they're kind of used, to justify the U.S.'s actual aims in some of these countries by getting deeply involved in their prison systems. Often the U.S.'s actual motive is just to maintain regional dominance. Like, it's not really about decreasing the drugs that come to the U.S. Otherwise, we would have had completely different tactics. And it's not really about making U.S. citizens safer from terror. Otherwise, we would have stopped as soon as we realized that, the detainees in Camp Buka became ISIS, and it became, more of a threat to U.S. people. Like, we wouldn't be doing these big international wars on drugs and terror. We're not doing them for the reasons that we say that we're doing them, but they're deeply related. And I think that's just important to mention as well.
Of course. And for those who are just tuning in, I'm speaking to Naseem Chatta, who is with the Alliance for Global Justice. And we are talking about prison imperialism. And Naseem, tell me a little bit more about that phrase, prison imperialism. Why do you and others at the Alliance use it?
Sure. So often, but not always, but almost always, the U.S. goes in to manage prisons in very poor places in the global south. And those countries where the U.S. goes in are often the U.S. proxies in their respective regions. Like, for example, in Asia, the countries where we're really involved in the prison systems are South Korea and Philippines. And those are both countries where the U.S. has a very long history of being deeply involved. So those tend to be the places where we are. Honduras, for example, would be a really good example in Central America of a place where the U.S. already has a ton of military bases and is already deeply enmeshed. And so when the U.S. goes in and builds prisons and restructures prison systems, we often see an increase in the number of prisoners, but also a huge increase in political arrests. So, which is kind of to be expected, because prisons are a really important aspect of the infrastructure of empire. And the infrastructure of empire includes police, the military, and economic infrastructure. So we think of prisons as central. We think prisons are very central to this because it's sort of emblematic of this new way that the U.S. is exerting control around the world. And it's not as explicit as it used to be. Like, we don't necessarily, we do have a lot of military bases, but we don't necessarily have military bases as much as we are moving towards things like joint military operations or sort of temporary bases that are not technically a base. Or we're getting more involved in sort of restructuring a country's existing and military police to meet our aims. And so prisons are could be sort of seen as this benign, almost civil part of civil infrastructure, like part of what keeps the country safe, and perhaps something that they would want, like a kind of U.S. aid that we're giving to them. But they actually get used as part of this infrastructure of control and intimidation against the country's own populations. So that's why we call it prison imperialism. We're speaking both to these U.S. prison management programs and what they're a part of, which is this bigger infrastructure of empire.
Well, you mentioned the former ambassador to Colombia, William Braunfeld, and mm-hmm. How he was talking about some of the failures that the United States has had. And in particular, you mentioned Camp Buca, which was a prison in Iraq where many of the leaders of ISIS came out of. And I just want to read you a quote that he said and get your response. He says, "I'd say that in terms of improving human rights standards and our allies' basic prison management, we were successful because in each case we have started from a prison system that was truly below bare minimum, even in Colombia. In terms of responsibility, we try to train and equip our allies, but at the end of the day, whatever they do must be the responsibility of that nation." End quote. Well, is there something coercive about these programs? Because otherwise, what's wrong with countries taking what they can from the programs and abandoning those aspects which seem irrelevant or unnecessary, and keeping those aspects that seem possibly useful to them or helpful?
Yeah, that would be really good if that could happen. I think what's one of the things that's important is that the majority of these countries are U.S. client states, and they're, as I said, kind of often right-wing, sort of neoliberal governments that are involved in repressing their own popular movements in their countries. So in actuality, it just hasn't worked that way. Like, I took a trip to Honduras recently, and the prison system actually, so the U.S. started getting involved in the prison system more recently there. And the people that I spoke to said that things had certainly changed. Like the prisons that I saw looked exactly like U.S. prisons. Like they were just big structures that were far away from the rest of the people, which is kind of really typical for a U.S. prison, that they would be sort of like somewhere really difficult to get to and geographically isolated. And that's actually kind of unusual in the rest of the world, where prisons are often more centrally located in communities. So that's one sort of hallmark of the U.S. prison management programs around the world. And it had sort of multiple layers of fencing, and it had like a disabled parking spot, which would have been great, except there was no other infrastructure for disabled people anywhere else in the country. So it was kind of like a copy-paste U.S. prison that was in Honduras. And this prison subsequently became really notorious for how violent it is. And this is a prison where people are saying it's actually way worse than what previously existed. Like, people who do work with, like, social work with prisoners are saying that this new brand of prison is actually shifting more towards solitary confinement, more towards punishment, more towards just filling up jail cells as much as possible, and it's just overall much more punitive of a system. So I think what's important is that the U.S. model of prisons is quite distinct. Like, the prisons that previously existed in Honduras were definitely had problems. Like, we're small, like, in cities. They were more, people were more able to visit family members than they are now. But the new ones, they're saying sort of that the new security, like, the new security is so much better, but really, since the problem was always corruption, the security hasn't really helped. Like, about 50 gang members escaped from this new supermax prison in Honduras, and, you know, somebody else was found wandering around with an AK-47 in Honduras, also from the supermax prison, and the reality is guards just let them out. So it wasn't really, like, a problem of security necessarily. It's more a problem of how the society is structured and sort of just, like, giving them a new prison hasn't really helped. It's shifted the culture more towards militarization. And it's also important to note that Honduras had a coup in 2009. And since then, the government has been extremely repressive of its own people. And this is the type of country where the U.S. is sort of handing them this kind of repressive tool and being, like, potentially repressive tool. And they don't really get a chance to sort of, like, that Honduran people don't really get a chance to take the parts they like and discard the parts they don't, because they're not really able to express their own will. It's sort of this more repressive government and the intermediary between the U.S. and the Honduran people.
I'm curious how open the State Department is to discussing its involvement in prisons around the world. Have you been able to talk to officials there? What do they say their goals are? And is this story getting much attention in the press?
Mm-hmm. I actually personally have not tried. That's interesting. I mean, I certainly could. But we did try to file a FOIA request to just learn more about how much money was actually spent and who it got, where it got spent, because that's one of the biggest questions that we have. We'd be extremely interested to know some more hard figures. But the, you know, we didn't get anything back from that request yet. Yeah, I could certainly reach out to State Department officials. That tends not really to be something my organization does, just because of our
sure,
sort
of course.
Longstanding antagonism between us and State Department, or our goals and State Department policies.
Yeah, so
I think that's an interesting question, and I would certainly be interested to hear sort of what they have to say about it.
Well, Nassim, I'm so sorry, but we're going to have to cut it off there. Thank you so much for talking to us today, and now for the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Earlier this week, the Drug Policy Alliance held a teleconference moderated by Queen Adesuyi, the policy associate at the DPA. It featured the thoughts of Representative Barbara Lee, Representative Ro Khanna, and Senator Cory Booker.
Attorney General Sessions continues to threaten states with medical and recreational use. However, 70% of U.S. voters oppose federal government interference. It's time to legalize marijuana, protect patients, and the right and right the wrongs of prohibition. This is where the Marijuana Justice Act changes the game. Until recently, federal marijuana legalization bills have failed to thoroughly address the lasting impacts of decades of prohibition and punishment that disproportionately impacted communities of color, low-income communities, and veterans. This is not just another legalization bill. The Marijuana Justice Act is the first bill in Congress to deschedule marijuana while also providing retroactive expungement for people with previous marijuana convictions. Convictions that oftentimes shut out folks, from, especially people of color, from the now booming legal market. I am honored and thankful for the leadership of everyone at this table. And with that said, I'd like to turn to our House lead sponsor, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, of the 13th District in California representing Oakland for her remarks.
Thank you very much, Queen. And I have to thank Senator Booker for your tremendous leadership on each and every issue of justice and equity. You're not only there, you've been leading for so, so many years. And to my colleague, Congressman Ro Khanna, boy, he has hit the ground running.
Yes, he has.
Here from Silicon Valley, right next door to my district, and it's such an honor to introduce this bill, the House version of Senator Booker's bill, with you. And I have to just say to Drug Policy Alliance, your work has been remarkable. We never would have gotten to this point had it not been for you. And believe you me, this legislation will end this destructive war on drugs. We intend to do that. So, we're here to announce, of course, the introduction of the Marijuana Justice Act, and believe it or not, here on the first day, we have 12 co-sponsors in the House, which is really remarkable, really remarkable. It's a roadmap not only on how we're going to end this war on drugs, but also begin to address mass incarceration and the disinvestment that has taken place in communities of color. But it goes much further also than just legalization. This bill is really an essential step in correcting the injustices of the failed war on drugs, as Queen said, namely the racial disparities in marijuana arrests and incarceration.
You can hear the full discussion on the January 19th edition of Cultural Baggage. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.